And also, unfortunately, we will have half an hour late today, but, yeah. Are we going to the full hour?
We'll go up to two, so I'll try my best and try to be as efficient as I can be, but we're going to be kicked out at 2 o'clock. All right. Let's see. So we started discussing a supersymmetric model last time, which had a two chiral superfield, and there was a cubic coupling between them. Okay. And so what we did, we studied vacua of this model. And so what we discovered that this model had a moduli space of vacua. So the vacua of this model are characterized by having an expectation value of H equal to zero. So when I write this, what I actually mean is that the expectation value. And then on the moduli space, L is anything. So if you wish, L is a coordinate that parametrizes me the vacuum. Okay, and so then what we did, we studied small fluctuations on the moduli space. So we looked at small fluctuations on the moduli space. And the way how we did that, so it was actually very straightforward. So we simply redefined our fields by saying that there is set an expectation value plus a small fluctuation. And the same thing we did for the H field, okay? And we used this condition, what is the expectation value should be in order to give rise to a supersymmetric vacuum. And so what we discovered last time is that X is a field, right? But it doesn't have a mass term. So X is a massless chiral superfield. Again, the way how we did this, we just substituted the VEV into the W, and so we obtained W as a function of X and Y. So this was an effective superpotential on the moduli space. And then by making a claim that X is massless chiral superfield, simply means that W effective does not have a term which is proportional to the x squared, right? So a term proportional to the x squared will be a mass term for our chiral superfield. And so in the expansion, such a term is absent. That's why we made a statement that x is massless. However, what we found that y, the fluctuations of the H field, y, those are massive fluctuations. So those are massive. And because they are massive fluctuations, so there is a mass associated with it. And again, I can read off what my mass is just by looking at the term proportional to y squared in this effective potential. We found that the mass of the y field is given by this expression. So what we're going to do now, we're going to study the moduli space, and we're going to study what will happen in this very interesting point. So interesting point is when expectation value of L equal to zero, right? So the moduli space is, there is no restriction whatsoever on this moduli space, right, of vacua. So it's just a complex plane parametrized by L, and I can be anywhere. And the thing is that this plane has a special point, and the special point is that the origin of this plane, I have massless Y excitations, And the excitations of Y are massive everywhere away from this point. So what we will try to see, we will try to see what is the signature of this phenomenon that happens. What usually is in supersymmetric quantum field theories, there are moduli space of vacua, and there can be special points on this moduli space where extra fields become massless. And that's going to be very important when we study Cyber-Huyton model at the very end. Okay, so let's see, how can we think about this space? So the way what we need to do, we need to think geometrically about moduli space. So I'm going to talk about geometry of a moduli space. If you want to look for a good introduction about the Kallis spaces, complex manifolds, and things like that, I can recommend a book by Nakahara. So this is a book, Geometry, Topology, and Physics for Physicists. I forgot the name. Some of you guys might. Right. So there is a very beautiful book. So there's almost no typos. And it's simple enough so that a person with pretty much no mass, just a standard physics education, can follow. So there are beautiful chapters on complex manifolds and Kallis manifolds and lots of the stuff that I will be mentioning without going into much detail. So the thing is that moduli space in our case, is a complex plane, so it's a C1. What I can say that classically there was a Kallis potential, right? So there, so we had two fields, L and H. And so we started with a configuration space. Configuration space of the theory, configuration space, is two complex dimensional. And I said that there is, when we talked about the Kallis manifold, right? So the Kallis manifold, we always thought about this as a piece in a supersymmetric actions that give rise to kinetic terms. So in this case, the classical Kallis potential will be like that. And I guess Matt was asking, so why is it called Kallis potential? So it turns out that the reason why it's called Kallis potential, because if I think about configuration space of my theory, this is a two-dimensional complex manifold. I can actually think of this as a complex manifold with a metric. Okay, so configuration space to begin with is a two-dimensional complex manifold, and coordinates on this manifold are two complex numbers, L and H. And so what I can do, I can ask what is a natural way to put a metric on this complex manifold. So there are various ways to do it. It turns out that if our complex manifold is Kallis, what this means, that there is a complex function defined on this Kallis manifold, okay, so which is called a Kallis potential. So this function depends on that I bar. So this function is called a Kallis potential. It's a scalar function. So this is a scalar function, function on a complex manifold. And the thing that makes our complex manifold Kallis is that there will be an explicit prescription. We do not discuss arbitrary metric on this Kallis manifold, but we discuss the metric. So if I call GI, J bar, those are the components of the metric. The metric will have a form as del I, del J bar of K. Okay, so the metric, and actually I forgot this. So I think that you can, for the Kallis manifold, those components of the metric would vanish either with two holomorphic and two anti-holomorphic indices. So the thing is that for us, Kallis manifold is a complex manifold on which I can define a scalar function, and this scalar function will determine for us a metric by the expression that I wrote here. So in our case, when we talk about the model, so the Keller potential is LL bar plus HH bar, and so the metric on this configuration space of the series is flat, right? So it's a two complex dimensional manifold, so if I write down the metric IJ bar, right? So here, if you wish, I will have LH derivative del with respect del over del L, del over del H. So here del over del L bar, del over del H bar. So if I'm going to compute what's the metric on my configuration space given this Keller potential, I will have that it's a that's a flat metric. Okay. Good. So the next thing that I want to mention is that. So now I'm gonna ask the question. So we. So this was a configuration space of the series, but what we are actually interested in, we're interested into a geometry of the vacuum space of the series. So the question is, what is the metric? What is the metric on the moduli space? Okay, and so the way how we can ask this question again, a moduli space will now be a one complex dimensional space, and we can ask. So if we think of this as a Keller manifold, there should be a Keller potential defined on this moduli space, and the Keller potential is going to be simply a Keller potential of the moduli space. So it's going to be just a Keller potential we started with, and then when we restrict this to the moduli space, So restriction to the moduli space tells us that what we need to do, we need to set the expectation value of the H field to zero. So a moduli space in this case will be, a Keller potential on the moduli space will be very simple. It will be LL bar. And so the metric on this moduli space, again, is flat. Okay, so I can go ahead and, but you can see if the metric is 1, 0, 0, and 1, then once I start computing the curvature of this metric, I will get 0. So the metric is trivial. So in this case, we have flat, non-singular, non-singular metric on the moduli space. So this statement that we just derived is correct classically. So this is just a classical statement, and we have to be very careful because we talk about Keller potential, and it is in the case of Keller potential. It's not protected by non-randomization. By the way, I think I probably want to write out one more line here. So when I write it this way, then the metric on my Keller manifold, dz bar j, right? So, and in the case of the Keller manifold, so this is del 2k over del z I, del z j bar, and then dz I dz j bar bar. Okay, so very good. So that was the statement. If we think about the theory classically, but in fact, what we know is that Keller potential will receive quantum corrections. Keller potential will receive quantum corrections, and so And so some things that we discussed before, so now we have a theory with a massless field X, right? And then there is a massive field Y, and this field Y has a mass, and Y absolute value squared is lambda, lambda L squared. And so what will happen, we can do a one loop computation. There will be a cubic interaction between those two fields. So due to cubic interactions, this is something that we discussed before, there will be a wave function renormalization. So there will be a wave function function renormalization. For the light field, for X, and that wave function renormalization will actually lead to a modification for the Keller potential for the L field. So now the classical Keller potential, which was just L, L bar, will be, will receive one loop corrections, okay? And so we can, the theory is renormalizable with the interaction. So this is just a, this is just a Vesumino model, right? By power counting, it's a renormalizable quantum field theory. And so we can compute a one loop correction there. So as I said, it will be just a, it's gonna be just a wave function renormalization due to loops of the heavy field. And explicitly, so I'm just gonna write down the answer one more time. So let's see. What that expression will look like. So then a one loop Keller potential. So we discussed before the wave function renormalization, and so it will act as one plus. So we spend a lot of time arguing why the sign must be plus here. And so what we will have here is absolute value of lambda squared. So this occurs only because we have a cubic interactions, and those cubic interactions are controlled by lambda. And then there will be a log. So there will be some cutoff in the theory. So here is the denominator. There will be a mass of the heavy field, which is an H field in our case, okay? And then here I have LL bar. Okay, so this is a one loop correction to a Keller potential, a one loop correction to the kinetic term of the light field due to loops of the heavy field, and it's, it just comes from the wave function renormalization of this light field. So in our case, the interesting thing is that as we move on a moduli space, the mass of the heavy field is not a constant, but it actually changes. So in our case, what happens is that they're saying, so there is some number here that I'm not writing down. So it will be one plus lambda, lambda bar. And then I have ln scale lambda squared over LL bar, LL bar. Okay, so I just use the fact, the result from the last discussion, what will be the mass of the Higgs field, and mass of the Higgs field is proportional to L. So the piece that is important for us, it's minus absolute value of lambda squared, and then I have ln LL bar times LL bar. So this is a correction, one loop modification to the Keller potential, right? And so actually the piece that I pulled out is an important So this will be a dominant contribution. Dominant contribution for small values of L, right? Because when L is small, the log is a large number. So, but notice what will happen now. So now we have still a Kelly manifold, except that the metrics that we would naturally put on this Kelly manifold will be governed by this new one loop corrected Kelly potential. And so the metric component GLL bar, so previously it was equal to 1, classically. Now at one loop level, what we have, it will be del 2 of K one loop, okay, divided by del L bar. And so when we will do the algebra, we will find out that it's equal to minus absolute value of lambda squared, and then I have ln LL bar over lambda squared plus some constant piece. Okay? So what we see that the metric on a moduli space will receive correction, and in particular, we can compute perturbatively any loop correction. And so we outline what the one loop correction on the moduli space will be. But now what you can see that there is a drastic change as we go from classical picture. So this is classical picture. Classical picture. And this is a quantum mechanical picture. This is a quantum mechanical picture. So classically, our manifold is flat, and there is nothing special. There is nothing special about L equals zero. Okay, L equals zero is not a special point. So the metric is regular there as well. On the other hand, if we do a one loop quantum correction, what we will find out, so that there is a huge warp factor as we approach L equals zero. And so in fact, what we have a metric singularity on the moduli space. So, so there is a metric singularity on the moduli space. Okay, and so, so the lessons that we're gonna take from this exercise is that if we want to know something, if there something interesting happens with the spectrum of our theory, what we have to do, we have to try to get a handle on a quantum moduli space of the theory, and in particular a metric on the moduli space. And what I want to point out, and then this is what we will discuss in more details now, is that the singularity in the metric happens precisely at the point where our field Y is massless, okay? So this is precisely the point where Y becomes massless. So this is a generic feature in supersymmetric models. So what we will see, what you will see if you read some research papers on the subject is that usually in many cases the singularities can be understood by simply asking the question, what is the massless state that's responsible for producing this singularity, okay? So let's try to understand, why the singularity showed up from the effective field theory perspective, okay? So give some physical intuition why this is happening, okay? So. And so this leads us to the question. Well, the thing is, okay. So I think I want to say some words before I go into more formal things. So here the theory was classical, right? And so our field was massive. And so what we did, we actually removed that field from our spectrum, right? So as far as we truncated our effective field theory only to a theory that included the light field L. Now, the reason why we have a singularity here is the reason that precisely at this point I said that the H field becomes massless. But if you have a massless field, the wave function of the massless field is not localized. It actually spreads all over the configuration space of the theory. And so if you wish, the singularity on the moduli space is a signature that our effective quantum field theory breaks down. What this means? This means that you did not include, by definition, effective field theory includes the light fields. Okay, you have to write down the interactions between the light field in your model. And what we did explicitly is that we assumed that that field is not important. And we found that that approximation actually kicks back to us once we ask the question about quantum moduli space for what we thought was our effective field theory. Okay, so let's discuss this more formally, and this leads. By more formally, I want to introduce the idea of integrating out and going from an effective field theory by reducing pretty much the effective field theory, integrating out the massive field. So this is the idea of integration out. Right. So let's suppose that we have a microscopic superpotential, and so this microscopic superpotential takes this form plus lambda lambda L squared H. So what you see again the situation when so here I made a simplified assumption. So here I just give a fixed constant mass to my field H. So H is massive. We have to be a little bit careful about the statements that I'm making, but you will see in a second why. LL is massless. Again, just by simply looking that there is no mass term. So we know that once we ask the question at low energies, we can use a non-renormalization theorem. And so we will get an effective superpotential, which is precisely the one that we started with. But somehow when we do that, this is not the minimum effective action, meaning that by definition, an effective action is something that is valid at low energies. And so if I ask the question, what does my dynamics look like at scales much less than the scale of set by this mass m, my effective action should not have, so effective action should not contain this massive field H, right? Because it's massive. And so during the loop corrections, when I have a scattering process, I cannot excite very easily the H modes, right? So then this tells me that what we can do if we ask the question at energy scales much less than m, we can integrate out H field. And the way to integrate out in a settled point approximation, what this means, this is equivalent to solve equation of motion for the field H, and substituted it. And substitute it into the superpotential. So rigorously, what this statement means when we will do this approximation, this means that what we are doing, you can think of it, is that compared to the question that we are asking, we are assuming that our field H is infinitely massive. Okay, so by replacing the quantum field H with its classical value, as dictated by equation of motion, implies that we are not allowing this field to fluctuate. And physically, not allowing to fluctuate means that we make this field infinitely massive. And that's why in reality, what this means, that whatever results we will obtain is valid at energy scales much less, well, definitely less than the mass of this field. Okay, so so let's see what we will have. So we will do it. We will do it in a classical manner, and then I will argue that the result is exact, and we will derive this using our method of the effective field theory. Okay, so. So when we sit in a supersymmetric vacuum, we must satisfy the F-term equation. Yes.
Very basic question.
Yeah.
So you're just doing the stationary phase approximation.
Yeah.
So isn't that exact? But we know it's going to be exact because its potential is less.
Yes. It's correct. It's not exact because there aren't connections.
Right.
It would have been exact if I had two six. So precisely because the field interacts, it will no longer be exact.
Okay.
In fact, I'm going to show you, let me just do what I want to do, and then I will tell you that there is a beautiful subtlety that actually looks that naively simple looking superpotential. So integrating out, meaning replacing it with the equation of motion, and the equation of motion in the context of symmetric field theories is vanishing, in particular vanishing of the F terms. So the F terms for the corresponding for the field H, which is del W over del H, and we have to set it equal to zero. So we have that MH plus lambda lambda L squared. Okay, and so this tells us that if I neglect the fluctuations in the H field, then I have to set, again, I'm always omitting the expectation value. Sometimes I am omitting, sometimes I am thinking of this as a fluctuation field, as a fluctuating field, so it's up to you to figure out what do I mean in each particular instance. So I would have to set my H field to minus lambda L squared over M. And now, what I can do, I can just write down the effective superpotential, which will involve only the light field, right? And so what I will get something like this. And so the thing is that what you notice is that this is a true effective field theory, because first of all, this is not a Zermelo model anymore. We have a non-renormalizable interaction, but also you see that L is a massless field. Okay, so L is a massless field, and actually we cannot think of this as a renormalizable model, and the reason for that is because it can only be valid for energies much less than M. Okay? So good. Let's see. So So I showed you how to do this integration out, and obtaining an effective action classically. But what I'm going to argue to you is that this statement is exact. There are no corrections. There are no corrections to this superpotential, both perturbatively and non-perturbatively. Again, as we think of this as an effective superpotential. So in other words, what I want to do, I want to implement the idea of integrating out in the context of the effective field theory. Remember that the first step, when we talk about effective field theory, we have to decide what fields we include in our low energy description. So there are the following steps that we go when we talk about effective field theory. The first thing, we need to decide on light fields, right, which we think are going to be important. And the second thing is look at the symmetries, look at the symmetries of the model, and then construct the most general, most general superpotential, which preserves the symmetries and most general superpotential, which is holomorphic, holomorphic in couplings. And then we can fix some numbers by taking a weak coupling limit. Okay, so what we want to do, we're going to say that, okay, we started with two fields, but there is only one field that is light. So we're going to assume that our effective superpotential just depend on L, right? So we will assume that the origin of the space is the origin in L, M, and lambda is not a special point, which allows us to write this down as a Lorentz series expansion, N1, N2, and N3. So this is a triple sum running from minus infinity to plus infinity of the type. Okay. Now, what we need to do, we need to implement this. So we just did the first step. We decided on what are the light fields in our model, and we assume that the origin, both in the field space of this light field and also in the space of couplings, which we think of as the expectation values of some auxiliary chiral superfield, is not special. That allows us to write down this Lorentz expansion. Then we have to look at the symmetries of the model. So this effective superpotential comes from a microscopic superpotential of this type. Right, so we have our microscopic superpotential, and what we can do, we can define global symmetries that are preserved microscopically, and we're going to make an assumption that those symmetries actually survive quantum corrections. So I'm going to introduce two U1 symmetries, U1H, U1L, and then there is a U1R symmetry. L and H, yes.
Should you write coefficients?
Sorry, yes.
N1, N2, and N3, those are just some numbers.
Yes, thank you. So those are just a charges that I will assign to my fields. So I have L, H, and then I have a coupling for which I can also assign some charges. So this guy. So I'm going to assign U1H and U1L charges in such a way that L carries a charge plus 1, H carries a charge plus 1. Each of them under its own symmetry. And then in order for me to make, so my W microscopic, so the H chart of W micro should be equal to zero, the L charge of W micro should be equal to zero, and the R charge of W micro should be equal to two. So I have to do my charge assignment in such a way. And so I'm just going to give you the answer, and you can immediately check that that's indeed will do the job. So I'm just going to assign a U1 charge plus 1 to L, and I'm going to make H not carry U1 or charge. And so I claim that this is a consistent charge assignment. I have to say that you might worry about anomalies, but there cannot be any anomalies in the charge assignment as long as we don't talk about gauge symmetry. Okay, so some of the symmetries can be anomalous, there is actually that sometimes it's actually very good because we can exploit it to get an idea of what the correct effective superpotential is. Okay, but this is not the issue here. Okay, so the way how we did it before, what we want to do, we want to construct monomials, right? So the most general superpotential is a polynomial, is a Laurent series. So we're going to do is construct monomials which satisfy the charges, right? So we ask which of the monomials of this type satisfies the symmetries. Okay, and so if I look at the U1H, right, so if I look at my charges, I find minus 2N2 minus N3 equal to zero. If I look at U1L, so I look at the monomial N1, N2, N3, so this guy has minus 2N3, and so my monomial, let me finish writing this. And the U1R is 2N2 plus N1 must be equal to 2. Yes?
Are those symmetries anomalous or not?
Sorry, what are those symmetries? Are what?
Yeah, how you can show that those symmetries are anomalous or not?
So forget about anomalies. We will talk about anomalies later. When we talk about gauge, quantum gauge series, I will talk about the novel. Right. So for now, the statement that you have to take is that wherever the symmetries I will write classically, they will be correct quantum mechanically. Very often, this is an assumption. This is what it said. So this is in particular relevant to a U1R symmetry. So we're making an assumption that a U1R symmetry is not broken by quantum corrections. And so we are posing that we think that we identify the correct light fields. Okay? So notice that here, what I did, I wrote the same out, and I assumed that this light field, which had exactly the same charge as a field L, is a microscopic model. So somehow, I'm assuming that it is this light field that was present microscopically at high energies, it will survive to low energies. Okay? In the models of the type we discuss right now, there is no fun. So that's actually a correct assumption. But in general, you have to be careful, meaning that you have to carefully identify what are your light fields. Okay. Of course, later you have to make consistency checks. So coming back to looking for, the questions that I'm asking, what are monomials of this type that satisfy the correct symmetries? So this is a system of three equations with three unknowns, and that's a non-degenerate system. So there is one solution, W effective, happens to be proportional to the over over x. Okay. And now if I use a weak coupling, I will even recover the coefficients that we did before. Right. So before I think right. So before we got this result, and you can see that this is an identical result that we obtained by using the rules of the effective field theory, identifying the light fields, asking what are the symmetries, and constructing the most general superpotential allowed by the symmetries. So the lesson that we all want to take from here is that I can do in superpotential, I can integrate out classically, and that statement is correct quantum mechanically. In superpotential, integrating. So this is, if you wish, a new type of non-randomization theorem. Before we said that if we start with a superpotential at some high energies, then we will get exactly the same superpotential at low energies, at least in nonlinear sigma model. But now what we did, we discovered a new theorem, which is that when we talk about the superpotential, in a superpotential we can integrate out massive fields classically. And the result is correct quantum mechanically. Okay, so again, we have to be very careful. This statement is correct only for the superpotential. So it is not correct. It is not correct for the Keller potential. So Keller potential, what does it mean integrating out in a Keller potential? So this means exactly the same as we did in a previous example. What this means is that we replace a heavy field with its expectation value. So we begin, for example, with a canonical Keller potential in this model. And so in order to get to a classical Keller potential for our effective description, what we have to do, we have to substitute h equals minus lambda L squared over m into this. And so what we will get, LL bar plus lambda over m absolute value squared LL bar squared. So this will be our effective Keller potential for the models that we study. But unlike the superpotential, this is not exact. So this is not exact, and it will receive quantum corrections. Okay, remember that in a simple model, when the field H had just a zero expectation value, then there was still a correction to a Keller potential coming from a loop, and those were wave function randomization. So here, as you can see, we have a much more interesting Keller potential to start with. Even classically, our field L is not canonically normalized. So in other words, this takes a form that L, right? And then I have times LL bar, and so that L even classically, right? So in the model we studied before, there was no wave function randomization, right? So here we find that there is a wave function randomization classically, and it's of this type. Again, classically, as you can see, there is no singularity on a moduli space, right? So if I compute a metric on the moduli space, it's non-singular. However, you can do an exercise and ask the question, are there going to be a singularity on the moduli space quantum mechanically or not? Okay? So any questions about this model? So this is, even though it might look simple, this is actually a very important subject, because the whole solution of the Seiberg-Witten model that hopefully we will talk in this course relies on the arguments of this type. So we will identify the moduli space. We will agree with you. We will agree with you what are our light degrees of freedom. And then we will be asking the question, what is, questions like what is a metric on the moduli space and things like that. And if there are singularities on the moduli space, and there will be a singularity on the moduli space, we're going to ask the question, what is the state that become massless? And in order to make a theory consistent at low energies, we would need to include those states in our description. All right, so let's see. Good. Great, guys. So we're done. So we're done with Wezzemino model, and in the remaining 7 minutes, or until we are kicked out of here, we're going to start a new topic, and now we are going into a real world, in the world of gauge theories. So the plan of the next couple lectures will be we will start again with a perturbative supersymmetry first. Then I forget about supersymmetry. I will talk about quantum gauge theories, anomalies, instantons, and type like that. And after that, we will solve an equal to gauge theory. Okay, we'll talk about solution type of fluid. Okay, so so we will start with supersymmetric quantum electrodynamic. And in fact, it won't be even electrodynamics because there will be no electrons to begin with. So we'll start with a U1 field. So remember, recall that classically, so this is when we have no supersymmetry, then the Lagrangian takes this form where F mu nu is the field strength. A nu minus del nu A mu. And so unfortunately, I will switch notation from A to V later. But and then there is a gauge symmetry plus del mu of optimum. All right. So I told you, we discussed a long time ago, that when we write down the most general superfield, it does not form an irreducible representation of a supersymmetry. And so we needed to introduce some constraints on the superfield. So some of the constraints that we discussed so far were constraint of this type. Okay, so if this guy is zero, so the field that satisfies this constraint was called a chiral superfield. And then there was a constraint of this type. And so this field we called anti-chiral superfield. And I said that this is only one type of constraint. The nice thing is that that constraint cuts the number of states in a supersymmetry multiplet to what we expect for an irreducible representation. But then I told you that there is another constraint that we can put on the general superfield. And so that leads to a definition, what I mean by a vector superfield. So by a vector superfield, I mean a most general superfield. So by definition, it's most general superfield subject to the following constraint. So the constraint is V equals B dash. So it's a real superfield. We impose the reality condition. And so if I take this and I ask what is the most general way I can write down this superfield, it turns out that I can write it down in this way. So this is C of X, so plus I theta chi of X. Then I have minus I theta bar chi bar of X, right? So in particular, in a most general superfield, those two fermions could have been different. Okay, so from now on, anything that's not theta has X dependence. I'm not going to write down X dependence anymore. But in a most general superfield, those were arbitrary. But now once I put a reality condition, that will be just a complex conjugate to each other. Okay, so reality condition constrains me how many components do I have in the superfield. So in particular, this C is a real scalar now, right? because a complex conjugate of it must be equal to itself. And then there are tons of other components. So there is a theta squared component, and this theta squared component can be complex. I'm just going to write it down in terms of the real field M and N like that. And then I need a complex conjugate to this. So this will be M minus IN, okay? Remember that in general, there was a vector superfield as well. So this is minus theta sigma mu theta bar b mu. And then there is I theta squared theta bar lambda bar plus I over 2 sigma bar mu del mu of chi. Okay, so I'm choosing, as you can see, I'm choosing a very particular parameterization, but I'm still keeping an arbitrary, you know, if you wish, an arbitrary combination. So in particular, lambda is any fermionic field. And I just, in principle, here before we would write out that this is an arbitrary, an arbitrary right-handed spinner. But what I did, I broke that arbitrary right-handed spinner into a new right-handed spinner plus a part that we had before. And then there is another term which is a complex conjugate of this one, theta. So I have lambda plus I over 2 sigma mu del mu chi bar. So notice that I did not make a typo. So when I put a bar, I do mean bar here, because when I'm contracting the indices, so here I will be contracting the dotted index. So I will be contracting an anti-chiral index. And so the last one is 1/2 theta squared theta bar squared. Again, here, in principle, there can be an arbitrary real combination. And I'm going to break it into two parts. I'm just going to write it down as D plus 1/2 box C. So I'm going to end right now just by telling what are the fields, what are the independent fields that we have. And you can check for yourself that what we wrote here actually satisfies this constraint. And you can convince yourself that that's the most general thing you can ever write down that will satisfy this constraint. So the field that we have is C, M, N. And then I have a vector field B mu, and then I have a field D. So all of those fields are real, okay? And one of them is a spin one. One of them is a spin one. So you can see that we still have many more components than required for an irreducible representation. And so what we will start discussing on Thursday is that there is a supersymmetric, if you wish, the generalization of the gauge symmetry. There is a supersymmetric analog of the gauge symmetry, and lots of these fields that you have here are actually gauge artifacts. And we will cut down the number of components. I forgot that there are two more, lambda and chi. Right. So those are spin 1/2, and then there are complex conjugate, of course, for example. All right, and so we will see how the super gauge symmetry will restrict further this field. All right, guys. So and maybe not next time, maybe in the other time, I will give you the final assignment.